Side 13. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Fincham. Continuing on page 440. Jubilee Jim just a-peddling through the country, winking at the ladies from Stockbridge up to Lee. Buy your gal a brooch for a fancy gown, buggy whip rigs for just a dollar down. Hey, come along, everybody, heading for the Jubilee. 2 miles down the road, Slothrop hits that canal Zoiler mentioned, takes a footpath down under the bridge where it's wet and cool for a minute. He sets off along the bank, looking for a boat to hijack. Girls in halters and shorts lie sunning brown and gold all along this dreaming grass slope. The clouded afternoon is mellowed to wind-softened edges, children kneeling beside the water with fishing lines, two birds in a chase across the canal soaring down and up in a loop into the suspended storm of a green treetop where they sit and begin to sing. With distance, the light gathers a slow ecru haze. Girls' flesh no longer bleached by the zenith sun now in gentler light reawakening to warmer colors. Faint shadows of thigh muscles, stretched filaments of skin cells saying, touch, stay. Slothrop walks on, past eyes opening, smiles breaking like kind dawns. What's wrong with him? Stay, sure, but what keeps him passing by? There are a few boats moored to railings, but always somebody with an eye out. He finally comes on a narrow, flat-bottomed little rig, oars in the locks and ready to go, nothing but a blanket upslope, a pair of high heels, man's jacket, stand of trees nearby. So Slothrop climbs right in and casts off. Have fun, a little nasty here. I can't, but I can steal your boat, huh? He hauls till sundown, resting for long stretches, really out of condition, cape smothering him in a cone of sweat so bad he has to take it off, finally. Ducks drift at a wary distance, water dripping off of bright orange beaks. Surface of the canal ripples with evening wind, sunset in his eyes, streaking the water red and gold, royal colors. Wrecks poke up out of the water, red lead and rust ripening in this light, bashed gray hull plates, flaking rivets, unlaid cable pointing hysterical strands to all points of the compass, vibrating below any hearing in the breeze. Empty barges drift by loose and forlorn. A stork flies over, going home. Below him, suddenly, the pallid arch of the Avis overpass ahead. Any farther and Slothrop's back in the American sector. He angles across the canal, debarking on the opposite bank and heads south, trying to skirt the Soviet control point the map puts someplace to his right. Massive movement in the dusk. Russian guardsmen, green-capped elite, marching and riding, poker-faced in trucks on horseback. You can feel the impedance in the fading day, the crowding, jittering wire loops. Potsdam warning, stay away! Stay away! The closer it comes, the denser the field around that cloaked international gathering across the hovel. Bodine's right, a gnat can't get in. Slothrop knows it, but just keeps on skulking along, seeking less sensitive axes of suspicion, running zigzags aimed innocuously south. Invisible. It becomes easier to believe in the longer he can keep going. Sometime back on Midsummer Eve, between midnight and one, fern seed fell in his shoes. He is the invisible youth, the armored changeling, Providence's little pal. Their preoccupation is with forms of danger the war has taught them, phantoms they may be doomed now, some of them, to carry for the rest of their lives. Fine for Slothrop, though. It's a set of threats he doesn't belong to. They are still back in geographical space, drawing deadlines and authorizing personnel, and the only beings who can violate their space are safely caught and paralyzed in comic books, they think. They don't know about Rocket Man here. They keep passing him, and he remains alone, blotted to evening by velvet and buckskin. If they do see him, his image is shunted immediately out to the boondocks of the brain, where it remains in exile with other critters of the night. Presently, he cuts right again toward the sunset. There's still that big superhighway to get across. Some Germans haven't been able to get home for 10-20 years because they were caught on the wrong side of some autobahn when it went through. Nervous and lead-footed now, Slothrop comes creeping up to the Avis embankment, listening to traffic vacuuming by above. Each driver thinks he's in control of his vehicle. Each thinks he has a separate destination, but Slothrop knows better. The drivers are out tonight because they need them where they are, forming a deadly barrier. Amateur Fritz von Opel's all over the place here, promising a lively sprint for Slothrop, snarling inward toward that famous S-curve where maniacs in white helmets and dark goggles once witched their wind-fared machinery around the banked brick in shrieking drifts, admiring eyes of colonels in dress uniforms, colonels' ladies in garbo fedoras, all safe up in their white towers, yet belonging to the day's adventure, each waiting for his own surfacing of the same mother violence underneath. Slothrop frees his arms from the cape, lets a lean gray Porsche whir by, then charges out, the red of its taillights flashing along his downstream leg, headlights of a fast-coming army truck now hitting the upstream one and touching the grotto of one eyeball to blue jigsaw. He swings sideways as he runs, screaming, "Hauptstufe!" which is the rocket man war cry, raises both arms, and the sea-green fan of the cape's silk lining hears brakes go on, keeps running, hits the center mall in a roll, scampering into the bushes as the truck skids past and stops. Voices for a while. Gives Slothrop a chance to catch his breath and get the cape unwound from around his neck. The truck finally starts off again. The southbound half of the Avos is slower tonight, and he can jog across easy, down the bank and uphill again into trees. Hey, leaps broad highways in a single bound. Well, Bodine, your map is perfect here, except for one trivial detail you sort of forgot to mention. Wonder why that was. It turns out something like 150 houses in Neubabelsberg have been commandeered and sealed off as a compound for the Allied delegates to the Potsdam Conference. And Jolly Jack Tar has stashed that dope right in the middle of it. Barbed wire, searchlights, sirens, security who've forgotten how to smile, thank goodness, which is to say Zeure Bummer for this special pass here. Stenciled signs with arrows read Admiralty, F.O., State Department, Chiefs of Staff. The whole joint is lit up like a Hollywood premiere, great coming and going of civilians in suits, gowns, tuxedos getting in and out of BMW limousines with flags of all nations next to the windscreens. Mimeographed handouts clog the stones and gutters. Inside the sentry boxes are piles of confiscated cameras. They must deal here with a strange collection of those showbiz types. Nobody seems too upset at the helmet, cape, or mask. There are ambiguous shrugging phone calls and the odd, feeble question, but they do let Max Schleipzig pass. A gang of American newspapermen comes through in a sharabang, clutching onto bottles of liberated Moselle, and they offer him a lift part way. Soon they have fallen to arguing about which celebrity he is. Some think he is Don Amici, others Oliver Hardy. Celebrity? What is this? Come on, says Slothrop, you just don't know me in this getup. I'm that Errol Flynn. Not everybody believes him, but he manages to hand out a few autographs anyhow. When they part company, the newshounds are discussing the candidates for Miss Rheingold 1946. Dorothy Hart's advocates are the loudest, but Jill Darnley has a majority on her side. It's all gibberish to Slothrop. It will be months yet before he runs into a beer advertisement featuring the six beauties and find himself rooting for a girl named Helen Rückert, a blonde with a Dutch surname who will remind him dimly of someone. The house at 2 Kaiserstrasse is styled in high Prussian boorish and painted a kind of barf brown, a color the ice-cold lighting doesn't improve. It is more heavily guarded than any other in the compound. Gee, Slothrop wonders why. Then he sees the sign with the place's stenciled alias on it. Oh, no. No, quit fooling. For a while he stands in the street shivering and cursing that Seaman Bodine for a bungler, villain, and agent of death. Sign says, "The White House." Bodine has brought him straight to the dapper, bespectacled stranger who gazed down the morning Friedrichstrasse to the face that has silently dissolved in to replace the one Slothrop never saw and now never will. The sentries with slung rifles are still as himself. The folds of his cape are gone to corroded bronze under the arc lighting. Behind the villa, water rushes. Music strikes up inside and obliterates the sound. An entertainment. No wonder it got in so easy. Are they expecting this magician, this late guest? Glamour, fame, He could run in and throw himself at somebody's feet, beg for amnesty, end up getting a contract for the rest of his life with a radio network, or even a movie studio. That's what mercy is, isn't it? He turns, trying to be casual about it, and goes moseying out of the light, looking for a way down to that water. The shore of the Gribnitzsee is dark, starlit, strung with wire, alive with roving sentries. Potsdam's lights, piled and scattered, twinkle across the black water. Clothrop has to go in up to his ass a few times to get past that wire and wait for the sentries to gather around a cigarette at one end of their beat before he can make a dash, cape flapping and soggy, up to the villa. Bodine's hashish is buried along one side of the house under a certain juniper bush. Clothrop squats down and starts scooping up dirt with his hands. Inside, it is some do. Girls are singing Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree, and if it ain't the Andrews sisters, it may as well be. They are accompanied by a dance band with a mammoth reed section. Laughing, sounds of glassware, multilingual chit-chat, your average weekday night here at the Great Conference. The hash is wrapped in tinfoil inside a moldering ditty bag. It smells really good. Aw, jeepers, why'd he forget to bring a pipe? Actually, it's just as well. Above Slothrop, at eye level, is a terrace, and espaliered peach trees and milky blossom. As he crouches, hefting the bag, French windows open and someone steps out on this terrace for some air. Slothrop freezes, thinking, invisible, invisible. Footsteps approach, and over the railing leans, well, this may sound odd, but it's Mickey Rooney. Slothrop recognizes him on sight, Judge Hardy's freckled madcap son, three-dimensional flesh in a tux and, am I losing my mind, face, Mickey Rooney. Stares at Rocket Man holding a bag of hashish, a wet apparition in helmet and cape. Nose level with Mickey Rooney's shiny black shoes, Slothrop looks up into the lit room behind, sees somebody looks a bit like Churchill, a lot of dames in evening gowns cut so low that even from this angle you can see more tits than they got at Minsky's, and maybe he even gets a glimpse of that President Truman. He knows he is seeing Mickey Rooney, though Mickey Rooney, wherever he may go, will repress the fact that he ever saw Slothrop. It is an extraordinary moment. Slothrop feels he ought to say something, but his speech centers have failed him in a drastic way. Somehow, hey, your Mickey Rooney seems inadequate. So they stay absolutely still, victory's night blowing by around them, and the grate in the yellow electric room scheming on, oblivious. Slothrop breaks it first, puts a finger to his mouth, and scuttles away, back around the villa and down to the shore, leaving Mickey Rooney with his elbows on that railing still watching. Back around the wire, avoiding sentries, close to the water's edge, swinging the ditty bag by its drawstring, some vague idea in his head now of finding another boat and just rowing back up that hovel. Sure, why not? It isn't till he hears distant conversation from another villa that it occurs to him he might be straying into the Russian part of the compound. Opines Slothrop. Well, in that case, I had better. Here comes that wiener again. Shapes only a foot away. They might have risen up out of the water. He spins around, catches sight of a broad, clean-shaven face, hair combed, lion-like, straight back, glimmering steel teeth, eyes black and soft as that Carmen Miranda's. Yes, no least accent to his English whispering. You were followed all the way. Others have grabbed Slothrop's arms. High in the left one, he feels something sharp, almost painless, very familiar. Before his throat can stir, he's away, on the wheel, clutching in terror to the dwindling white point of himself in the first windrush of anesthesia, hovering coyly over the pit of death. A soft night, smeared full of golden stars, the kind of night back on the Pampas that Leopoldo Lugones liked to write about. The U-boat rocks quietly on the surface. The only sounds are the chug of the billy goat cutting in now and then below decks, pumping out the bilges, and El Ñato back on the fantail with his guitar playing Buenos Aires Tristes y Milongas. De Laustegui is down working on the generator. Luz and Felipe are asleep. By the 20-millimeter mounts, Graciela Imago Portales lounges wistfully. In her day, she was the urban idiot of B.A., threatening nobody, friends with everybody across the spectrum, from Cipriano Reyes, who intervened for her once, to Acción Argentina, which she worked for before it got busted. She was a particular favorite of the literati. Borges is said to have dedicated a poem to her. el laberinto de tu incertidumbre me trama con la disquietante luna. The crew that hijacked this U-boat are here out of all kinds of Argentine manias. El Ñato goes around talking in 19th century gaucho slang. Cigarettes are pitos, butts are puchos. Isn't caña he drinks, but la tacuara, and when he's drunk, he's mamao. Sometimes Felipe has to translate for him. Felipe is a difficult young poet with any number of unpleasant enthusiasms, among them romantic and unreal notions about the gauchos. He is always sucking up to El Ñato. The Laustegui, acting ship's engineer, is from Entre Rios and a positivist in the regional tradition. A pretty good knife hand for a prophet of science, too, which is one reason El Ñato hasn't made a try yet for the godless Mesopotamian Bolshevik. It is a strain on their solidarity, but then it's only one of several. Luz is currently with Felipe, though she's supposed to be Squalidosi's girl. After Squalidosi disappeared on his trip to Zurich, she took up with the poet on the basis of a poignant recitation of Lugones's Pavos Reales, one balmy night flying to off Matosinhos. For this crew, nostalgia is like seasickness. Only the hope of dying from it is keeping them alive. Squalidosi did show up again, though, in Bremerhaven. He had just been chased across what was left of Germany by British military intelligence with no idea why. Why didn't you go to Geneva and try to get through to us? I didn't want to lead them to Ibargüengoitia. I sent someone else. Who? Belaustegui wanted to know. I never got his name, Squalidosi scratched his shaggy head. Maybe it was a stupid thing to do. No further contact with him? None at all. They'll be watching us then, Belaustegui sullen. Whoever he is, he's hot. You're a fine judge of character. What did you want me to do? Take him to a psychiatrist first? Weigh options? Sit around for a few weeks and think about it? He's right, El Ñato, raising a large fist. Let women do their thinking, their analyzing. A man must always go forward, looking life directly in the face. You're disgusting, said Graciela Imago Portales. You're not a man, you're a sweaty horse. Thank you, El Ñato, bowing in all gaucho dignity. Nobody was yelling. The conversation in the steel space that night was full of quiet, damped S's and palatal Y's. The peculiar, reluctant poignancy of Argentine Spanish brought along through years of frustrations, self-censorship, long roundabout evasions of political truth, of bringing the state to live in the muscles of your tongue, in the humid intimacy just inside your lips. Pero che, no sos argentino. In Bavaria, Squalidosi was stumbling through the outskirts of a town, only minutes ahead of a Rolls-Royce with a sinister dome in the roof, green perspex you couldn't see through. It was just after sunset. All at once, he heard gunshots, hoofbeats, nasal and metallic voices in English, but the quaint little town seemed deserted. How could this be? He entered a brick labyrinth that had been a harmonica factory. Splashes of bell metal lay forever unwrung in the foundry dirt. Against a high wall that had recently been painted white, the shadows of horses and their riders drummed. Sitting watching from workbenches and crates were a dozen individuals Squalidosi recognized right away as gangsters. Cigar ends glowed and mouths whispered back and forth in German. The men ate sausages, ripping away the casings with white teeth, well cared for, that flashed in the light from the movie. They were sporting the Caligari gloves which now enjoy a summer vogue in the zone. Bone white, except for the four lines and deep violet fanning up each glove back from wrist to knuckles. All wore suits nearly as light-colored as the teeth. It seemed extravagant to Squalidosi after Buenos Aires and Zurich. The women crossed their legs often. They were tense as vipers. In the air was a grassy smell, a smell of leaves burning that was strange to the Argentine who, terminally homesick, had only the smell of freshly brewed mate after a bitter day at the racetrack to connect it with. Crowned window frames gave out on the brick factory courtyard where summer air moved softly. The film light flickered blue across empty windows as if it were breath trying to produce a note. The images grew blunt with vengeance. Yay! Screamed all the zootsters, white gloves bouncing up and down. Their mouths and eyes were as wide as children's. The reel ended, but the space stayed dark. An enormous figure in a white zoot suit stood, stretched, and ambled right over to where Squalidosi was crouching, terrified. Day after you, amigo? Please. No, no, come on, watch with us. It's a Bob Steele. He's a good old boy. You're safe in here. For days, as it turned out, the gangsters had known Squaladosi was in the neighborhood. They could infer to his path, though he himself was invisible to them, by the movements of the police, which were not. Blodgett Waxwing, for it was he, used the analogy of a cloud chamber, and the vapor trail a high-speed particle leaves. I don't understand. Not sure I do either, pal, but we have to keep an eye on everything, and right now all the Hepcats are going goofy over something called nuclear physics. After the movie, Squaladosi was introduced to Gerhard von Göhl, also known by his nom de pègre, Der Springer. Seems von Göhl's people and Waxwings were in the course of a traveling business conference, rumbling the roads of the zone in convoy, changing trucks and buses so often there was no time for real sleep, only catnaps, in the middle of the night, the middle of a field, no telling when, you'd have to pile out, switch vehicles and take off again along another road. No destinations, no fixed itinerary. Most of the transportation was furnished through the expertise of veteran automotive jobber Eduard Sanktwolka, who could hotwire anything on wheels or caterpillar tracks, even packed around a custom-built ebony case full of the rotor arms, each in its velvet recess, to every known make, model, and year, in case the target's owner had removed that vital part. Squaladosi and von Göhl hit it off right away. This film director-turned-marketeer had decided to finance all his future movies out of his own exorbitant profits. Only way to be sure of having final cuts, Ferdad? Tell me, Squaladosi, are you too pure for this, or could your anarchist project use a little help?
It would depend what you wanted from us.
The film, of course. What would you like to do? How about Martin Fierro?
Keep the customer happy. Martin Fierro is not just the gaucho hero of a great Argentine epic poem. On the U-boat, he is considered an anarchist saint.
Hernandez's poem has figured in Argentine political thinking for years now. Everybody's had his own interpretation, quoting from it often as vehemently as politicians in 19th century Italy used to, from I Promessi Sposi.
It goes back to the old basic polarity in Argentina, Buenos Aires versus the provinces, or, as Felipe sees it, central government versus gaucho anarchism, of which he has become the leading theoretician. He has one of these round brim hats with balls hanging from it. He has taken to lounging in the hatchways, waiting for Graciela. Good evening, my dove. Haven't you got a kiss for the gaucho Bakunin? You look more like a Groucho Marx, Graciela drawls, and leaves Felipe to go back to the treatment he's working on for von Göhl, using El Niato's copy of Martin Fierro, which has long been thumbed into separate loose pages, and smells of horses, each of whose names El Niato, tearfully Mamao, can tell you. A shadowed plane at sundown, an enormous flatness, camera angle is kept low, people coming in slowly, singly or in small groups, working their way across the plain into a settlement at the edge of a little river. Horses, cattle, fires against the growing darkness, far away at the horizon a solitary figure on horseback appears and rides in all the way in as the credits come on. At some point we see the guitar slung on his back. He is a payador, a wandering singer. At last he dismounts and goes to sit with the people at the fire. After the meal and a round of caña, he reaches for his guitar and begins to strum his three lowest strings, the bordona, and sing. Aquí me pongo a cantar al compás de la vihuela. Que el hombre que lo desvela una pena extraordinaria, como la ave solitaria con el cantar se consuela.
So, as the gaucho sings, his story unfolds, a montage of his early life on the estancia. Then the army comes and conscripts him, takes him out to the frontier to kill Indians. It is the period of General Roca's campaign to open the pampas by exterminating the people who live there, turning the villages into labor camps, bringing more of the country under the control of Buenos Aires. Martin Fierro is soon sick of it. It's against everything he knows is right. He deserts. They send out a posse, and he talks the sergeant in command over to his side. Together they flee across the frontier to live in the wilderness, to live with the Indians. That's part one. 7 years later, Hernandez wrote A Return of Martin Fierro, in which the gaucho sells out,
assimilates back into Christian society, gives up his freedom for the kind of constitutional Gesellschaft being pushed in those days by Buenos Aires. A very moral ending, but completely opposite to the first. What should I do? Von Wehr seems to want to know. Both parts or just part one?
Well, begins Squalidosi, I know what you want, but I might get better mileage out of two movies if the first does well at the box office, but will it?
Of course it will. Something that antisocial? But it's everything we believe in, Squalidosi protests. But even the freest of gauchos end up selling out. You know, that's how things are.
That's how Gerhard von Gerl is, anyway.
Graciela knows the man. There are lines of liaison, sinister connections of blood and of wintering at Punta del Este, through Annalinas Alemanas, the IG branch in Buenos Aires, on through Spott Billig Film AG in Berlin, another IG outlet, from whom von Gerl used to get cut rates on most of his film stock, especially on the peculiar and slow-moving Emulsion J, invented by Laszlo Jampf, which somehow was able, even under ordinary daylight, to render the human skin transparent to a depth of half a millimeter, revealing the face just beneath the surface. This emulsion was used extensively in von Gerl's immortal Alpdrücken, and may even come to figure in Martin Fierro. The only part of the epic that really has von Gerl fascinated is a singing duel between the white gaucho and the dark El Moreno. It seems like an interesting framing device. With Emulsion J, he could dig beneath the skin colors of the contestants, dissolve back and forth between J and ordinary stock like sliding in and out of focus, or wipe. How he loved wipes, from one to the other in any number of clever ways. Since discovering that Schwarzkommando are really in the zone, leading real, paracinematic lives that have nothing to do with him or the phony Schwarzkommando footage he shot last winter in England for Operation Blackwing, Springer has been zooming around in a controlled ecstasy of megalomania. He is convinced that his film has somehow brought them into being. It is my mission, he announces to Squalidosi with the profound humility that only a German movie director can summon, to sow in the zone seeds of reality. The historical moment demands this, and I can only be its servant. My images somehow have been chosen for incarnation. What I can do for the Schwarzkommando, I can do for your dream of pampas and sky. I can take down your fences and your labyrinth walls. I can lead you back to the garden you hardly remember. His madness clearly infected Squalidosi, who then eventually returned to the U-boat and infected the others. It seemed what they had been waiting for. Africans, daydreamed the usually all-business Berlaustegi at a staff meeting. What if it's true? What if we've really come back to the way it was before the continents drifted apart? Back to Gondwanaland, whispered Felipe, when Rio de la Plata was just opposite Southwest Africa, and the Mesozoic refugees took the ferry not to Montevideo, but to Lüderitzbucht. The plan is to get somehow to the Lüneburg Heath and set up a small estancia. Von Gerl is to meet them there. By the gun mounts, tonight, Graciela Imago Portales dreams. Is von Gerl a compromise they can tolerate? There are worse foundations than a film. Did Prince Potemkin's fake villages survive Catherine's royal progress? Will the soul of the gaucho survive the mechanics of putting him into light and sound? Or will someone ultimately come by, von Gerl or another, to make a part two and dismantle the dream? Above and beyond her the zodiac glides, a north hemisphere array she never saw in Argentina, smooth as an hour hand. Suddenly there's a long smash of static out of the PA, and Belaustegui is screaming, "Der Aal! Der Aal!" The eel, wonders Graciela, the eel? Oh, yes, the torpedo. Ah, Belaustegui is as bad as El Niato. He feels his own weird obligation to carry on in German submarine. It is just precisamente a seagoing tower of Babel here. The torpedo? Why is he screaming about the torpedo? For the good reason that the U-boat has just appeared on the radar screen of the USS John E. Badass. Smile, U-boat, as a skunk or unidentified pip. And the Badass, in muscular post-war reflex, is now lunging in at flank speed. Reception tonight is perfect. The green return, fine-grained as a baby's skin, confirms Spiros Spider Telaniekstasis, radar man second class. You can see clear out to the Azores. It is a mild, fluorescent summer evening on the sea, but what's this on the screen now? Moving fast, sweep by sweep, broken as a drop of light from the original pip, tiny but unmistakable, in toward the unmoving center of the sweep, closer now. Baker, 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 holler somebody down in sonar, loud and scared over the phone. That means hostile torpedo on the way. Coffee messes go crashing, parallel rulers and dividers sliding across the glass top of the dead reckoning tracer as the old tin can goes heeling over around onto an evasion pattern that was already obsolete during the Coolidge administration. Their owl's pale tunnel of wake is set to intersect the badass's desperate sea squirm about midships. What intervenes is the drug onarine, as the hydrochloride. The machine from which it has emerged is the coffee urn in the mess hall of the John E. Badass. Playful seaman Bodine, none other, has seeded tonight's grounds with a massive dose of Laszlo Jamp's celebrated intoxicant scored on Bodine's most recent trip to Berlin. The property of time modulation, peculiar to onarine, was one of the first to be discovered by investigators. It is experienced, writes Schätzlein in his classic study, in a subjective sense, put it this way, it's like stuffing wedges of silver sponge right into your brain. So, out in the mellow sea return tonight, the two fatal courses do intersect in space, but not in time. Not nearly in time. What Belaustegui fired his torpedo at was a dark rust old derelict, carried passively by currents and wind, but bringing to the night something of the skull, an announcement of metal emptiness, of shadow that has spooked even stronger positivists than Belaustegui. And what passed into visual recognition from the small speeding pip on the badass's radar screen proved to be a corpse, dark in color, perhaps a North African, which the crew on the destroyer's aft 3-inch gun mount spent half an hour blowing to pieces as the gray warship slid by at a safe distance, fearful of plague. Now what sea is this you have crossed exactly, and what sea is it you have plunged more than once to the bottom of, alerted, full of adrenaline, but caught, really, buffaloed under the epistemologies of these threats that paranoid you so down and out, caught in this steel pot, softening to devitaminized mush inside the soup stock of your own words, your waste submarine breath. It took the Dreyfus affair to get the Zionists out and doing, finally. What will drive you out of your soup kettle? Has it already happened? Was it tonight's attack and deliverance? Will you go to the heath and begin your settlement and wait there for your director to come? Under a tall willow tree, beside a canal, in a jeep, in the shade, sit Chicherny and his driver, Jabayev, a teenage Kazakh dope fiend with pimples and a permanently surly look, who combs his hair like the American crooner Frank Sinatra, and who is at the moment frowning at a slice of hashish and telling Chicherny, "Well, you should have taken more than this, you know." "I only took what his freedom is worth to him," explains Chicherny. "Where's that pipe now?" "How do you know what his freedom is worth to him? You know what I think? I think you're going a little zone-happy out here." This Jabayev is more of a sidekick, really, than a driver, so he enjoys immunity up to a point in questioning Chicherny's wisdom. "Look, peasant, you'll read the transcript in there. That man is one unhappy loner. He's got problems. He's more useful running around the zone thinking he's free, but he'd be better off locked up where he doesn't even know what his freedom is, much less what it's worth. So I get to fix the price, which doesn't matter to begin with."
"Pretty authoritarian," sneers young Jabayev. "Where's the matches?"
It's sad, though. Chicherny likes Slothrop. He feels that in any normal period of history, they could easily be friends. People who dress up in bizarre costumes have a savoir-vivre, not to mention the sort of personality disorder, that he admires. When he was a little boy back in Leningrad, Chicherny's mother sewed by hand a costume for him to wear in a school entertainment. Chicherny was the wolf. The minute he put on the head, in front of the mirror by the icon, he knew himself. He was the wolf. The sodium-amytol session nags at the linings of Chicherny's brain as if the hangover were his own. Deep, deep, further than politics, than sex or infantile terrors, a plunge into the nuclear blackness. Black runs all through the transcript, the recurring color black. Slothrop never mentioned Enzian by name, nor the Schwarzkommando, but he did talk about the Schwarzgerät. And he also coupled Schwarz with some strange nouns in the German fragments that came through. Black Woman, Black Rocket, Black Dream. The new coinages seem to be made unconsciously. Is there a single root, deeper than anyone has probed, from which Slothrop's black words only appear to flower separately? Or has he, by way of the language, caught the German mania for name-giving, dividing the creation finer and finer, analyzing, setting namer more hopelessly apart from named, even to bringing in the mathematics of combination, hacking together established nouns to get new ones, the insanely, endlessly diddling play of a chemist whose molecules are words? Well, the man is a puzzle. When Gaily Tripping first sent word of his presence in the zone, Chicherina was only interested enough to keep a routine eye on him, along with the scores of others. The only strange item, which grew stranger as surveillance developed, was that he seemed to be alone. To date, Slothrop has still not recorded, tagged, discovered, or liberated a single scrap of A4 hardware or intelligence. He reports neither to SPOG, CIOS, BAFO, TI, nor any American counterpart, indeed to no known allied office. Yet he is one of the faithful. The scavengers, now following industriously the fallback routes of A4 batteries from the Hook of Holland all across Lower Saxony. Pilgrims along the roads of mirror and peace, a sacred relic, every scrap of manual, a verse of scripture. But the ordinary hardware doesn't interest Slothrop. He is holding out, saving himself for something absolutely unique. Is it the Black Rocket? Is it the 00000? Endian is looking for it, and for the mysterious Schwarzgerät. There is a very good chance that Slothrop, driven by his black phenomenon, responding to its needs though they be hidden from him, will keep returning cycle after cycle to Ensign until the mission is resolved, the parties secured, the hardware found. It's a strong hunch, nothing Chicherin will ever put into writing. Operationally, he's alone as Slothrop is out here, reporting, if and when, direct to Malyankov's special committee under the Council of People's Commissars, the TSAGI assignment being more or less a cover. But Slothrop is his boy. He'll be followed, all right. If they lose him, why, they'll find him again. Too bad he can't be motivated personally to go get Entian, but Chicherina is hardly fool enough to think that all Americans are as easy to exploit as Major Marvey with his reflexes about blackness. It's a shame. Chicherina and Slothrop could have smoked hashish together, compared notes on Gailey and other girls of the ruins. He could have sung to the American songs his mother taught him, Kiev lullabies, starlight lovers, white blossoms, nightingales. Next to run across that Englishman, Yabayev looking curiously at his hands on the steering wheel, or American, or whatever he is, find out, will you, where he got this shit. Make a note of that, orders Chicherina. They both start cackling insanely there, under the tree. Slothrop comes, too, in episodes that fade in and out of sleep. Measured in exchanges in Russian, hands at his pulse, the broad green back of someone just leaving the room. It's a white room, a perfect cube, though for a while he can't recognize cubes, walls, dental, anything too spatial. Only the certainty that he's been shot up yet again with that sodium amytal, that feeling he knows. He's on a cot, still in Rocket Man garb, helmet on the floor down next to the ditty bag of hash. Uh-oh. Though it requires superhuman courage in the face of doubts about whether or not, he manages to flop over and check out that dope. One of the tinfoil packages looks smaller. He spends an anxious hour or two undoing the top to reveal, sure enough, a fresh cut, raw green against the muddy brown of the great chunk. Footsteps ring outside and a heavy door slides to below. Shit. He lies in the white cube, feeling groggy, feet crossed, hands behind head, doesn't care especially to go anyplace. He dozes off and dreams about birds, a close flock of snow buntings blown in a falling leaf of birds among the thickly falling snow. It's back in Berkshire. Slothrop is little and holding his father's hand. The raft of birds swings, buffeted, up sideways through the storm, down again looking for food. Poor little guys, says Slothrop, and feels his father squeeze his hand through its wool mitten. Broderick smiles. They're all right. Their hearts beat very, very fast. Their blood and their feathers keep them warm. Don't worry. Slothrop wakes again to the white room, the quiet. Raises his ass and does a few feeble bicycle exercises, then lies, slapping on new flab that must have collected on his stomach while he was out. There is an invisible kingdom of flab, a million cells at large.
And they all know who he is. As soon as he's unconscious, they start off, everyone, piping in high, horrible little Mickey Mouse voices. Hey, fellas, hey, come on. Let's all go over to Slothrop's. The big sap ain't doing anything but laying on his ass. Come on, oh, boy. Take that, Slothrop mutters. Hey, and that. Arms and legs apparently working, he gets up groaning, puts his helmet on his head, grabs the ditty bag and leaves by the door, which shudders all over along with the walls when he opens it. Aha! Yes, it's a movie set. Slothrop finds himself in a dilapidated old studio. Dark, except where yellow sunlight comes through small holes, rusted catwalks, creaking under his weight, black burned-out Klieg lights, the fine netting of spider webs struck to graph work by the thin beams of sun. Dust has drifted into corners and over the remains of other set, phony gemütlich love nests, slant-walled and palm-crowded nightclubs, papier-mâché Wagnerian battlements, tenement courtyards in stark expressionist white-black built to no human scale, all tapered away in perspective for the rigid lenses that stared here once. Highlights are painted sets, which is disturbing to Slothrop, who keeps finding these feeble yellow streaks, looking up sharply, then all around for sources of never there, getting more agitated as he prowls the old shell, the girders 50 feet overhead almost lost in shadows, tripping over his own echoes, sneezing from the dust he stirs. The Russians have pulled out all right, but Slothrop isn't alone in here. He comes down a metal staircase through shredded webs, angry spiders in their dried prey, rust crunching under his soles, and at the bottom feels a sudden tug at escape. Being still a little foggy from that injection, he only flinches violently. He is held by a gloved hand, the shiny kid stretched over precycles, a woman in a black Parisian frock with a purple and yellow iris at her breast. Even damped by the velvet, Slothrop can feel the shaking of her hand. He stares into eyes rimmed soft, a black ash. Separate grains of powder on her face, clear as pores, the powder missed or was taken from by tears. This is how he comes to meet Margarita Erdmann, his lightless summer hearth, his safe memories of the inflatsend with dread, his helpless Lisaura. She's packed another of the million rootless, looking for her daughter, Bianca, bound east for Swinemünde, if the Russians and Poles will let her. She's in Neubabelsberg on a sentimental side trip, hasn't seen the old studios in years. Through the 20s and 30s, she worked as a movie actress at Tempelhof and Staaken, too, but this place was always her favorite. Here she was directed by the great Gerhard von Gerl through dozens of vaguely pornographic horror movies.
He was a genius from the beginning of her. Never star material, she admits freely. No Dietrich, nor vamp a la Brigitte Helm. A touch of whatever it was they wanted, though they... Slothrop, they, Erdmann, I don't know. Nicknamed her the anti-Dietrich, not destroyer of men, but doll, languid, exhausted. I watched all our films, she recalls, some of them 6 or 7 times. I never seemed to move, not even my fach, those long, long gauze. It could have been the same over and over, even running away. I always had to be chased by those madmen criminals. Still, I was so... bracelets flashing, stolid, so monumental. When I wasn't running, I was usually strapped or chained to something. Come, I'll show you. Leading Slothrop now to what's left of a torture chamber, wooden teeth snapped from its rack wheel, plaster masonry peeling and chipped, dust rising, dead torches cold and lopsided in their sconces. She lets wood most of the silver paint now slither clattering fingers. This was a set for Alpdrücken. Gerhardt in those days was still all for exaggerated lighting. Silver-gray collects in the fine wrinkled gloves as she dusts off the rack and lies down on it, like this, raising her arms, insisting he for the tin manacles to her wrist ankles. The light came from above and below at the same time so that everyone had two shadows, Cain's and Abel's, Gerhardt told us. It was at the height of his symbolist period. Later on he began to use more natural light to shoot more on location. They went to Paris, Vienna, to Herrenchiemsee in the Bavarian Alps. Von Gerl had dreamed of making a film about Ludwig II. It nearly got him blacklisted. The rage then was all for Frederick. It was considered unpatriotic to say that a German ruler could also be a madman. But the gold mirrors, the miles of Baroque ornament, drove Von Gerl himself a little daft, especially those long corridors. Corridor metaphysics is what the French call this condition. Old-time corridor hepcats will chuckle fondly at description of a girl long after running out of film, still dollying with a boobish smile on his face down the golden vistas. even on orthochromatic stock. The warmth of it survived in black and white, though the film was never released, of course. Das Wütende Reich sits still for that. Endless negotiating, natty little men with Nazi lapel pins trooping through, interrupting the shooting, walking face first into the glass wall. They would have accepted anything for Reich, but von Goll stood fast. He walked the trope. To compensate, he started immediately on Good Society, which, it's said, delighted Goebbels so he saw it three times, giggling in the arm the fellow sitting next to him, who may have been Adolf Hitler. Margarita played the lesbian in the café, the one with his whipped to death at the end by the... Remember? Heavy legs in silk stockings now with a hard, machined look, slick knees sliding against each other as the memory moves in, exciting her. Slothrop, too. She smiles up at his tautening deerskin crotch.
He was beautiful. Both ways it didn't matter. You remind me of him a little, especially those boots.
Good Society was our second film, but this one...
This one?
Abdrücken was our first. I think Bianca is his child. She was conceived while we were filming this. He played the Grand Inquisitor who tortured me. Ah, we were the Reich's sweethearts. Greta Erdmann and Max Schlepsig. Wonderfully together.
Max Schlepsig?
Repeats Slothrop, goggling. Quit fooling. Max Schlepsig? It wasn't his real name. Erdmann wasn't mine, but Earth in it was politically... Earth, soil, folk, a code, which they, staring, knew how to decipher. Max had a very Jewish name, something Ski, and Gerhard thought it more prudent to give him a new one.
Greta, somebody also thought it prudent to name me Max Schlepsig. He shows her the pass he got from Zoira Boomer. She gazes at it, then at Slothrop briefly. She's begun to tremble again, some mixture of desire and fear.
Ain't...
Knew what?
Looking away, submissive.
Knew he was dead. He disappeared in 38. They've been busy, haven't they?
Slothrop has picked up, in the zone, enough about European passport psychoses to want to comfort her. This is forged. The name's just a random alias. The guy who made it probably remembered Schlepsig from one of his movies.
Random.
Actressy smile. Beginnings of a double chin. One knee drawn up as far as these leg irons will let her. Another fairy tale word. The signature on your card is Max's. Somewhere in Stefania's house on the Vistula, I have a steel box full of his letters. Don't you think I know that Latin Z engineer style, the flower he made out of the G at the end? You could hunt all the zone for your forger. They wouldn't let you find him. They want you right here, right now.
Well, what happens when paranoid meets paranoid? A crossing of solipsisms. Clearly. The two patterns create a third, a moiré, a new world of flowing shadows, interferences. Want me here? What for?
For me.
Whispering out of scarlet lips, open, wet. Well, there's this hard-on here.
He sits on the rack, leans, kisses her, presently unlacing his trousers and peeling them down far enough to release his cock, bounding up with a slight wobble into the cool studio.
Put your helmet on.
Okay.
Are you very cruel?
Don't know.
Could you be, please? Find something to whip me with, just a little, just for the warmth.
Nostalgia. The pain of a return home. He rummages around through inquisitional props, gyves, thumbscrews, leather harness, before coming up with a miniature cat of nine tails, a black forest elf's whip, its lacquered black handle carved in a bas-relief orgy. The lashes padded with velvet to hurt but not to draw blood.
Yes, that's perfect. Now, on the insides of my thigh.
But somebody has already educated him. Something that dreams Prussian and wintering among their meadows. Their cursive lash marks wait across the flesh of their sky, so bleak, so incapable of any shelter, wait to be summoned.
No. No, he still says there, but he knows better. His meadows now, his sky, his own cruelty. All Margarita's chains and fetters are chiming, black skirt furled back to her waist, stockings pulled up tight in classic cusps by the suspenders of the boned black rig she's wearing underneath. How the penises of Western men have leapt for a century to the sight of this singular point at the top of a lady's stocking, this transition from silk to bare skin and suspender. It's easy for non-fetishists to sneer about Pavlovian conditioning and let it go at that, but any underwear enthusiast worth his unwholesome giggle
can tell you there is much more here. There is a cosmology of nodes and cusps and points of osculation, mathematical kisses, singularities. Consider cathedral spires, holy minarets, the crunch of train wheels over the points as you watch peeling away the track you didn't take. Mountain peaks rising sharply to heaven, such as those to be noted at scenic Berchtesgaden. The edges of steel razors, always holding potent mystery. Rose thorns that prick us by surprise. Even, according to the Russian mathematician Friedmann, the infinitely dense point from which the present universe expanded. Pace, the change from point to no point, carries a luminosity and enigma at which something in us must leap and sing or withdraw in fright. Watching the A4 pointed at the sky, just before the last closes, watching that singular point at the very top of the rocket with the fuses, do all these points imply, like the rockets, an annihilation? What is that, detonating in the sky above the cathedral, beneath the edge of the razor, under the rose? And what's waiting for Slothrop? What unpleasant surprise past the tops of Greta's stockings here, laddering suddenly, the pallid streak flowing down thigh over intricacies of knee and out of sight? What waits past this whine and crack of velvet lashes against her skin, long red stripes on the white ground, her moans, the bruise-colored flower that cries at her breast, the jingling of the hardware holding her down? He tries not to tear his victim's stockings or whip too close to her stretched vulva, which shivers unprotected between thighs agape and straining amid movements of muscle erotic, subdued, monumental as any silver memory of her body on film. She comes once, then perhaps again, before Slothar puts the whip down and climbs on top, covering her with the wings of his cape, her Schleipzig surrogate, his latest reminder of Katya. And they commence fucking. The old phony rack groaning beneath them, Margarita whispering, "God, how you hurt me, and ah, Max!" And just as Slothrop's about to come, the name of her child, strained through her perfect teeth, a clear extrusion of pain that is not in play, she cries, "Bianca!" "Yes, bitch, yes, little bitch, poor helpless bitch, you're coming, can't stop yourself, now I'll whip you again till you bleed." Thus Pokler's whole front surface, eyes to knees, flooded with tonight's image of the delicious victim bound on her dungeon rack, filling the movie screen, close-ups of her twisting face, nipples under the silk gown amazingly erect, making lies of her announcements of pain. Bitch, she loves it, and Lainey no longer solemn wife, embittered source of strength, but Margarita Erdmann underneath him on the bottom for a change as Perkler drives in again, into her again. Yes, bitch, yes. Only later did he try to pin down the time. Perverse curiosity. 2 weeks since her last period. He had come out of the Ufa Theater on the Friedrichstrasse that night with an erection, thinking like everybody else only about getting home, fucking somebody, fucking her into some submission. God, Erdmann was beautiful. How many other men, shuffling out again into Depression Berlin, carried the same image back from Aufdrücken to some drab, fat excuse for a bride? How many shadowed children would be fathered on Erdmann that night? It was never a real possibility for Perkler that Lainey might get pregnant, but looking back, he knew that had to be the night, Aufdrücken night, that Ilse was conceived. They fucked so seldom anymore. It was not hard to pinpoint. That's how it happened, a film. How else? Isn't that what they made of my child, a film? He sits tonight by his driftwood fire in the cellar of the onion-topped Nikolaikirche, listening to the sea. Stars hang among the spaces of the great wheel, precarious to him as candles and good-night cigarettes. Cold gathers along the strand. Child phantoms, white whistling, tears never to come, range the wind behind the wall. Twists of faded crepe paper blow along the ground, scuttling over his old shoes. Dust under a moon newly calved twinkles like snow, and the Baltic crawls like its mother glacier. His heart shrugs in its scarlet net, elastic, full of expectation. He's waiting for Ilse, for his movie child, to return to Zwölfkinder, as she has every summer at this time. Storks are asleep among 2- and 3-legged horses, rusted gearwork and splintered roof of the carousel, their heads jittering with air currents and yellow Africa, dainty black snakes 100 feet below meandering in the sunlight across the rocks and dry pans. Oversized crystals of salt lie graying, drifted in the cracks of the pavement, in the wrinkles of the dog with saucer eyes in front of the town hall, the beard of the goat on the bridge, the mouth of the troll below. Frida the pig hunts a new place to nestle and snooze out of the wind. The plaster witch, wire mesh visible at her breasts and haunches, leans near the oven, her poke at corroded Hansel in perpetual arrest. Gretel's eyes lock wide open, never a blink, crystal heavy lashes batting at the landings of gorilla winds from the sea. If there is music for this, it's windy strings and reed sections standing in bright shirt fronts and black ties all along the beach, a robed organist by the breakwater, itself broken, crusted with tides, whose languettes and flues gather and shape the resonant spooks here, the candle flame memories, all trace, particle and wave, of the 60,000 who passed, already listed for taking once or twice this way. Did you ever go on holiday to Zwölfkinder? Did you hold your father's hand as you rode the train up from Lübeck, gaze at your knees or at the other children like you, braided, ironed, smelling of bleach, boot wax, caramel? Did small change jingle in your purse as you swung around the wheel? Did you hide your face in his wool lapels, or did you kneel up in the seat, looking over the water, trying to see Denmark? Were you frightened when the dwarf tried to hug you? Was your frock scratchy in the warming afternoon? What did you say, what did you feel when boys ran by snatching each other's caps and too busy for you? She must have always been a child on somebody's list. He only avoided thinking about it. But all the time she was carrying her disappearance in her drawn face, her reluctant walk, and if he hadn't needed her protection so much, he might have seen in time how little she could protect anything, even their mean nest. He couldn't talk to her. It was arguing with his own ghost from 10 years ago, the same idealism, the adolescent fury, items that had charmed him once, a woman with spirit, but which he came to see as evidence of her single-mindedness, even, he could swear, some desire to be actually destroyed. She went out to her street theater each time, expecting not to come back, but he never really knew that. Leftists and Jews in the streets, all right, noisy, unpleasant to look at, but the police will keep them channeled. She's in no danger unless she wants to be. Later, after she left, he got a little drunk one forenoon, a little sentimental, and went out at last, his first and last time, hoping that somehow the pressures of fate or crowd hydrodynamics might bring them together again. He found a street full of tan and green uniforms, truncheons, leather, placards fluttering, unstable in all modes but longitudinal, scores of panicked civilians. A policeman aimed a blow at him, but Perkler dodged, and it hit an old man instead, some bearded old unreconstructed geezer of a Trotskyite. He saw the strands of steel's cable under black rubber skin, a finicky smile on the policeman's face as he swung, his free hand grasping his opposite lapel in some feminine way, the leather glove of the hand with the truncheon unbuttoned at the wrist, and his eyes flinching at the last possible moment as if the truncheon shared his nerves and might get hurt against the old man's skull. Perkler made it to a doorway, sick with fear. Other police came running as some dancers run, elbows close to sides, forearms thrusting out at an angle. They used fire hoses to break up the crowd, finally. Women slid like dolls along the slick cobbles and on tram rails, the thick gush catching them by belly and head, its brute white vector dominating them. Any of them might have been Lainey. Perkler shivered in his doorway and watched it. He couldn't go out in the street. Later he thought about its texture, the network of grooves between the paving stones. The only safety there was ant-scaled. Down and running the streets of Ant City, boot-soles hanging overhead like black thunder, you and your crawling neighbors in traffic all silent, jostling, heading down the gray darkening streets. Perkler knew how to find safety among the indoor abscissas and ordinates of graphs. Finding the points he needed not by running the curve itself, not up on high stone and vulnerability, but instead tracing patiently the X's and Y's, P, in parentheses, W, meters per second in parentheses, T sub 1, degrees Kelvin in parentheses, moving always by safe right angles along the faint lines. When he began to dream about the rocket with some frequency, it would sometimes not be a literal rocket at all, but a street he knew was in a certain district of the city, a street on a certain small area of the grid that held something he thought he needed. The coordinates were clear in his mind, but the street eluded him. Over the years, as the rocket neared its fullness, about to go operational, the coordinates switched from the Cartesian X and Y of the laboratory to the polar azimuth and range of the weapon as deployed. Once he knelt on the laboratory floor of his old rooming house in Munich, understanding that if he faced exactly along a certain compass bearing, his prayer would be heard. He'd be safe. He wore a robe of gold and orange brocade. It was the only light in the room. Afterward, he ventured out into the house, knowing people slept in all the rooms, but feeling a sense of desertion. He went to switch on a light, but in the act of throwing the switch, he knew the room had really been lit to begin with, and he had just turned everything out. Everything. The A4 operational at last hadn't crept up on him. Its coming true was no climax. That hadn't ever been the point. "They're using you to kill people," Lainey told him as clearly as she could. "That's their only job, and you're helping them." "We'll all use it someday to leave the earth to transcend," she laughed. "Transcend? From Perkler?" "Someday. Honestly trying. They won't have to kill. Borders won't mean anything. We'll have all outer space."
"Oh, you're blind."
Spitting it, as she spat his blindness at him every day. That and Kedavergehorsamkeit. A beautiful word he can no longer imagine in any voice but hers. But really, he did not obey like a corpse. He was political, up to a point. There was politics enough out at the rocket field. The Army Weapons Department was showing an ever-quickening interest in the amateur rocketeers of the Verein für Raumschifffahrt. And the VFR had recently begun making available to the Army records of their experiments. The corporations and the universities, the Army said, didn't want to risk capital or manpower on developing anything as fantastic as a rocket. The Army had nowhere to turn but to private inventors and clubs like the VFR.
"Shit," said Lainey. "They're all in on it together. You really can't see that, can you?"
Within the society, the lines were drawn clear enough. Without money, the VFR was suffocating. The Army had the money and was already financing them in roundabout ways. The choice was between building what the Army wanted, practical hardware, or pushing on in chronic poverty, dreaming of expeditions to Venus.
"Where do you think the Army's getting the money?" Lainey asked.
"What does it matter? Money is money."
"No."
Major Weissmann was one of several gray eminences around the rocket field, able to talk with every appearance of sympathy and reason to organized thinker and maniac idealist alike. All things to all men, a brand new military type, part salesman, part scientist. Perkler, the all-seeing, the unmoving, must have known that what went on in the VFR committee meetings was the same game being played in Lainey's violent and shelterless street. All his training had encouraged an eye for analogies, in equations, in theoretical models, yet he persisted in thinking the VFR was special, preserved against the time. And he also knew at first hand what happens to dreams with no money to support them. So, presently, Perkler found that by refusing to take sides, he'd become Weissmann's best ally. The Major's eyes always changed when he looked at Perkler, his slightly prissy face to relax into what Perkler had noticed in random mirrors and display windows on his own face when he was with Lainey. The blank look of one who is taking another for granted. Weissmann was as sure of Perkler's role as Perkler was of Lainey's, but Lainey left at last. Perkler might not have had the will. He thought of himself as a practical man. At the rocket field, they talked continents, encirclements, seeing years before the general staff the need for a weapon to break ententes, to leap like a chess knight over panzers, infantry, even the Luftwaffe. Plutocratic nations to the west, communists to the east, spaces, models, game strategies, not much passion or ideology, practical men. While the military wallowed in victories not yet won, the rocket engineers had to think non-fanatically about German reverses, German defeat, the attrition of the Luftwaffe and its decline in power, the withdrawals of fronts, the need for weapons with longer ranges. But others had the money, others gave the orders, trying to superimpose their lusts on something that had its own vitality, on a technologique they'd never begin to understand. As long as the rocket was in research and development, there was no need for them to believe in it. Later, as the A4 was going operational, as they found themselves with a real rocket in being, the struggles for power would begin in earnest. Perkler could see that. They were athletic, brainless men without vision, without imagination, but they had power, and it was hard for him not to think of them as superior, even while holding them in a certain contempt. But Laney was wrong. No one was using him. Perkler was an extension of the rocket, long before it was ever built. She'd seen to that. When she left him, he fell apart. Pieces spilled into the Hinterhof, down the drains, away in the wind. He couldn't even go to the movies. Only rarely did he go out after work and try to fish lumps of coal from the Spree. He drank beer and sat in the cold room, autumn light reaching him after impoverishments and fadings from gray clouds off courtyard walls and drain pipes, through grease-darkened curtains, bled of all hope by the time it reached where he sat shivering and crying. He cried every day, some hour of the day, for a month, till a sinus got infected. He went to bed and sweated the fever out. Then he moved to Kummersdorf, outside Berlin, to help his friend Mondaugen at the rocket field. Temperatures, velocities, pressures, fin and body configurations, stabilities and turbulences began to slip in to replace what Laney had run away from. There were pine and fir forests out the windows in the morning instead of a sorrowful city courtyard. Was he giving up the world, entering a monastic order? One night he set fire to 20 pages of calculations. Integral signs weaved like charmed cobras. Comical curly D's marched along like hunchbacks through the fire edge into billows of lace ash. But that was his only relapse. At first he helped out in the propulsion group. No one was specializing yet. That came later when the bureaus and paranoia and the organization charts became plan views of prison cells. Kurt Mondaugen, whose field was radioelectronics, could come up with solutions to cooling problems. Perkler found himself redesigning instrumentation for measuring local pressures. That came in handy later at Peenemünde, when they often had to lead over 100 measuring tubes from a model no more than 4 or 5 centimeters diameter. Perkler helped in working out the Halbmodell solution, bisecting the model lengthwise and mounting it flat side to the wall of the test chamber, bringing the tubes through that way to all the manometers outside. A Berlin slum dweller, he thought, knew how to think in half rations, but it was a rare moment of pride. No one could really claim credit 100% for any idea. It was a corporate intelligence at work. Specialization hardly mattered, class lines even less. The social spectrum ran from von Braun, the Prussian aristocrat, down to the likes of Perkler, who would eat an apple in the street. Yet they were all equally at the rocket's mercy. Not only danger from explosions or falling hardware, but also its dumbness, its dead weight, its obstinate and palpable mystery. In those days, most of the funding and attention went to the propulsion group. Problem was just to get something off the ground without having it blow up. There were minor disasters. Aluminum motor casings would burn through. Some injector designs would set up resonant combustion in which the burning motor would try to shriek itself to pieces. And then in 1934, a major one. Dr. Wamke decided to mix peroxide and alcohol together before injection into the thrust chamber to see what would happen. The ignition flame backed up through the conduit into the tank. The blast demolished the test stand, killing Dr. Wamke and 2 others. First blood. First sacrifice. Kurt Mondaugen took it as a sign. German mystics who grew up reading Hesse, Stefan George, and Richard Wilhelm, ready to accept Hitler on the basis of Damian metaphysics, he seemed to look at fuel and oxidizer as paired opposites, male and female principles uniting in the mystical egg of the combustion chamber, creation and destruction, fire and water, chemical plus and chemical minus. Valency, Perkler protested, a condition of the outer shells, that's all. Think about it, said Mondaugen. Faringer, an aerodynamics man, who went out in the pine woods at Peenemünde with his Zen bow and roll of pressed straw to practice breathing, draw and loosing over and over. It seemed rather rude at a time when his colleagues were being driven insane by what they called Folksamkeitfaktor, a problem with getting the rocket's long axis to follow the tangent at all points to its trajectory. The rocket for this Faringer was a fat Japanese arrow. It was necessary in some way to become one with rocket, trajectory, and target. Not to will it, but to surrender of the role of firer. The act is undivided. You are both aggressor and victim. Rocket and parabolic path, and... Peckler never knew what the man was talking about. But Mondaugen understood. Mondaugen was the bodhisattva here, returned from exile in the Kalahari and whatever light had found him there, returned to the world of men and nations to carry on in a role he'd chosen deliberately, but without ever explaining why. In Südwest, he had kept no journals, written no letters home. There had been an uprising by the Bondo Schwarz in 1922, and general turmoil in the country. His radio experiments interrupted, he sought refuge, along with a few score other whites, in the villa of a local landowner. The place was old, cut off on all sides by deep ravines. After a few months of siege and debauchery, haunted by a profound disgust for everything European, Montauken went out alone into the bush, ended up living with the Ovadjimba, the aardvark people who are the poorest of the Hereros. They accepted him with no questions. He thought of himself, there and here, as a radio transmitter of some kind, and believed that whatever he was broadcasting at the time was them. In his electro-mysticism, Shriod was as basic as the cross in Christianity. Think of the ego, the self that suffers a personal history bound to him as the grid. The deeper and true self is the flow between cathode and plate, the constant, pure flow. Signals, sense data, feelings, memories, reading are put onto the grid and modulate the flow. We live lives that are wave forms, constantly changing with time, now positive, now negative. Only at moments of great serenity is it possible to find the pure, the informationless state of signal zero.
In the name of the cathode, the anode, and the holy grid? Said Puckler.
Yes, that's good, Montauken smiled. Closest to the zero among them all, perhaps, was the African Ensign, the protege of Major Weissmann. At the Versuchsanstalt, behind his back, he was known as Weissmann's monster, probably less out of racism than at the picture the two of them made, Ensign towering a foot over Weissmann, who was balding, scholarly, peering up at the African through eyeglass lenses thick as bottles, skipping now and then to keep up as they stalked over the asphalt and through the labs and offices, Ensign dominating every room and landscape of those early rocket days. Perkler's dearest memory of him is his first, in the testing room at Kummersdorf, surrounded by electric colors, green nitrogen bottles, a thick tangle of red, yellow, and blue plumbing, Ensign's own copper face with the same kind of serenity that now and then drifted into Montaugen's. Watching in one of the mirrors the image of a rocket engine beyond the safety partition, in the stale air of that room snapping with last-minute anxieties, nicotine craving, unreasonable prayer, Ensign was at peace. Perkler moved to Peenemünde in 1937, along with some 90 others. They were invading gravity itself, and a beachhead had to be laid down. Never in his life, not even as a laborer in Berlin, did Perkler work so hard. The vanguard spent the spring and summer converting a little island, the Greifswalder Oie, into a testing station. Resurfacing road, stringing cable and telephone line, putting up living quarters, latrines and storage sheds, excavating bunkers, mixing concrete, endlessly stevedoring in crates of tools, bags of cement, drums of fuel. They used an ancient ferry boat for cargo runs between the mainland and the Oie. Perkler remembers the worn red plush and scratched lacquer inside the dim cabins, the neglected brightwork, the asthmatic cry of her steam whistle, odors of sweat, cigarette smoke, and diesel fuel, the trembling of arm and leg muscles, the tired joking, the exhaustion toward the end of each day, his own new calluses struck to gold by the late sun. The sea was mostly calm and blue that summer, but in the autumn the weather turned. Rain swept in from the north, the temperature plunged, wind tore into storage tents, giant waves boomed all night long. The water was white for 50 meters out from shore, spray feathered landward all the big breakers. Perkler, billeted at a fisherman's cottage, came in from his evening walks behind a fine mask of salt. Lot's wife. What disaster had he dared to look back on? He knew. He reverted that season to childhood, to the wounded dog. During those wet and solitary walks, he brooded about Lainey. He concocted scenarios in which they would meet again in some elegant or dramatic setting, ministry, theater lobby. Two or three jeweled and beautiful women hanging to him, generals and industrialists springing to light his American cigarettes and listening to his offhand solutions to problems Lainey would only vaguely understand. The most satisfying of these fantasies would come while Perkler was on the toilet. He'd tap his feet, fanfares would whisper through his lips as he felt that pleasant anticipation. But the burden of his poor Berlin self lingered. He had spoken of it, listened, probed, and yet it would not dissolve or flee. It persisted. begging all the doorways of his life, beseeching silently with eyes, with hands quite sure of their guilt-making craft.
Busy work at Peenemünde, and good company at Herr Halliger's inn on the Oye.
All marking time till good firing weather, and Perkler more vulnerable than he'd ever been. His cold and womanless nights, the card and chess games, the oil beer-drinking sessions, the nightmares he had to find his own way up out of because there was no other hand now to shake him awake, nobody to hold him when the shadows came on the window shade, all caught up with him that November. And maybe he allowed the protective reflex because something scary was happening. Because once or twice, deep in the ephedrine pre-dawns, nodding, ya, ya, stimmt, ya, for some design you were carrying, not in but on your bobbing, out past your side vision, bobbing and balanced almost, he would become aware of a drifting away. Some assumption of Perker into the calculations, drawings, graphs, and even what raw hardware there was, each time, soon as it happened, he would panic and draw back into the redoubt of waking Perkler, heart pounding, hands and feet aching, his breath catching in a small-voiced, Something was out to get him. Something here among the paper. The fear of extinction named, Perkler knew it was the rocket beckoning him in. If he also knew that in something like this extinction he could be free of his loneliness and his failure, still he wasn't quite convinced. So he hunted as a servo valve with a noisy input wheel across the zero between the two desires, personal identity and impersonal salvation. Mondhagen saw it all. He could see into Perkler's heart. In his compassion, not surprisingly, he had no free advice for his friend. Perkler would have to find his own way to his zero signal, his true course. By 38, the Peenemünde facility was taking shape, and Perkler moved over to the mainland. With hardly more to go on than Stoda's treatise on steam turbines and helpful data now and then from universities at Hanover, Darmstadt, Leipzig, and Dresden, the propulsion group were testing a rocket engine of 1.5 tons thrust, 10 atmospheres combustion pressure, and 60 seconds duration. They were getting exhaust velocities of 1,800 meters per second, but the value they were aiming for was 2,000. They called it the magic number, and they meant it literally, as some gamblers on the stock market know when to place stop orders, feeling by instinct not the printed numbers but the rates of change, knowing from first and second derivatives in their skin when to come in, stay, or go, so there are engineering reflexes tuned always to know at any moment what, given the resources, can be embodied in working hardware. What is feasible. On the day that a 2,000 meter per second exhaust became feasible, the A4 itself suddenly came in reach. The danger then lay in being seduced by approaches that were too sophisticated. No one was immune. Hardly a designer there, including Perkler, didn't come up with at least one monster rig, some gorgon's head, writhing with pipes, tubes, complicated falderol for controlling pressures, solenoids on top of pilot valves, on auxiliary valves, on backup valves. Hundreds of pages on valve nomenclature were printed as appendices to these weird proposals, all promising huge pressure differences between the inside of the chamber and the nozzle exit. Beautiful, as long as you didn't care much about those millions of moving parts behaving together too reliably. But to get a dependable working motor, one the military could use in the field to kill people, the real engineering problem now was to keep things as simple as possible. The model currently being fired was the A3, christened not with champagne, but with flasks of liquid oxygen by the playful technicians. Emphasis had begun to shift from propulsion to guidance. Telemetry on the flight tests was still primitive. Thermometers and barometers were sealed in a watertight compartment with a movie camera. During flights, the camera photographed the needles swinging on the gauges. After the flight, the film was recovered and the data played back. Engineers sat around looking at movies of dials. Meantime, Heinkels were also dropping iron models of the rocket from 20,000 feet. The fall was photographed by Ascanius and a theodolite rigs on the ground. In the daily rushes, you would watch the frames at around 3,000 feet where the model broke through the speed of sound. There has been this strange connection between the German mind and the rapid flashing of successive stills to counterfeit movement for at least 2 centuries. since Leibniz, in the process of inventing calculus, used the same approach to break up the trajectories of cannonballs through the air. And now Pickler was about to be given proof that these techniques had been extended past images on film to human lives. He had returned to his quarters about sundown, too tired or preoccupied to be much affected by the furnace of colors in the flower gardens, the daily changes to the skyline of the station, even the absence of noise today from the testing stands. He smelled the ocean and could almost imagine himself as someone who lives year-round at a seaside resort but seldom gets to the beach. Now and then, over in Peenemünde West, a fighter plane took off or landed, the motors softened by distance to tranquil purring. A late sea breeze flickered. He had no warning other than a smile from a colleague who lived a few cubicles away and was coming down the barrack stairs as Pickler was going up. He entered his own cubicle and saw her sitting on the bed, her toes pointed in next to a flowered carpet bag, skirt pulled over her knees, and eyes anxiously, fatally, looking into his.
Herr Pickler, I am your... Ilse. Ilse.
He must have picked her up, kissed her, drawn the curtain. Some reflex. She was wearing in her hair a ribbon of brown velvet. He remembered her hair as lighter, shorter, but then it does grow and darken. He looked slantwise into her face, all his emptiness echoing. The vacuum of his life threatened to be broken in one strong inrush of love. He tried to maintain it with seals of suspicion, looking for resemblances to the face he'd last seen years ago over her mother's shoulder, eyes still puffy from sleep angled down across Lainey's rain-coated back. Going out a door he thought closed for good, pretending not to find resemblances. Perhaps pretending. Was it really the same face? He'd lost so much of it over the years, that fat, featureless child's face. He was afraid now even to hold her, afraid his heart would burst. He said, "How long have you been waiting?"
"Since lunchtime."
She'd eaten in the canteen. Major Weissmann had brought her up on the train from Stettin, and they had played chess. Major Weissmann was a slow player, and they hadn't finished the game. Major Weissmann had bought her sweets, and had asked her to say hello, and sorry he couldn't stay long enough to see Pickler.
Weissmann, what was this? A blinking, tentative fury grew in Pickler. They must have known everything all this time. His life was secretless, as this mean cubicle with its bed, commode, and reading light. So, to stand between him and this impossible return, he had his anger to preserve him from love he couldn't really risk. He could settle for interrogating his daughter. The shame he felt was acceptable, the shame and coldness, but she must have picked it up, for she sat now very still except for nervous feet, her voice so subdued he missed parts of her answers. They had sent her here from a place in the mountains, where it was chilly even in summer, surrounded by barbed wire and bright hooded lights that burned all night long. There were no boys, only girls, mothers, old ladies living in barracks stacked up in bunks, often two to a pallet. Lainey was well. Sometimes a man in a black uniform came into the barracks and Mutti would go away with him and stay away for several days. When she came back, she didn't want to talk or even to hug Ilse the way she usually did. Sometimes she cried and asked Ilse to leave her alone. Ilse would go off and play with Johanna and Lily underneath the barracks next door. They had scooped a hideout there in the dirt, furnished with dolls, hats, dresses, shoes, old bottles, magazines with pictures, all found out near the barbed wire, the treasure pile. They called it a huge refuse dump that always smoldered day and night. You could see its red glow out the window from the top bunk where she slept with Lily nights when Lainey was away. But Pickler was hardly listening. He had the only datum with any value, that she was somewhere definite, with a location on the map and authorities who might be contacted. Could he find her again? Fool. Could he somehow negotiate her release? Some man, some red, must have got her into this. Kurt Montaugen was the only one he could trust, though Pickler knew before they spoke that the role Montaugen had chosen would keep him from helping. They called them re-education camps. They're run by the SS. I could talk to Weissmann, but it might not work. He had known Weissmann in Südwest. They had shared the months of siege inside Foppel's villa. Weissmann was one of the people who had driven Montaugen, finally, away to live in the bush, but they had found a rapprochement here among the rockets, either for sun-blasted, holy man reasons it was not for Pickler to understand, or because of some deeper connection which had always been there.
They stood on the roof of one of the assembly buildings, the Oya across the water 6 miles away, clearly visible, which meant a change in the weather tomorrow. Steel was being hammered somewhere out in the sunlight, hammered in cadences, purified as the song of some bird. Blue Peneminde shivered around them in all directions, a dream of concrete and steel masses reflecting the noon heat. The air rippled like camouflage. Behind it, something else seemed to carry on in secret. At any moment, the illusion they stood on would dissolve and they would fall to earth. Perkla stared across the marshes, feeling helpless. I have to do something, don't I? No, you have to wait. It's not right, Montalcon. No. What about Ilse? Will she have to go back? I don't know, but she's here now. So, as usual, Perkla chose silence. Had he chosen something else, back while there was time, they all might have saved themselves, even left the country. Now, too late, when at last he wanted to act, there was nothing to act on. Well, to be honest, he didn't spend much time brooding about past neutralities. He wasn't that sure he'd outgrown them anyway. They took walks, he and Ilse, by the stormy shore, fed ducks, explored the pine forests. They even allowed her to watch a launching. It was a message to him, but he didn't understand till later what it meant. It meant that there was no violation of security. There was no one she could tell who mattered. The noise of the rocket ripped at them. For the first time, then, she moved close and held him. He felt that he was holding on to her. The motor cut off too soon, and the rocket crashed somewhere over in Peneminde West in Luftwaffe territory. The dirty pillar of smoke drew the screaming fire engines and truckloads of workers by in a wild parade. She took in a deep breath and squeezed his hand. Did you make it do that, puppy? End of side 13. To continue, turn the cassette over.